2FM with Owen McDermott.
So joining me in studio right now is a man who is immensely talented, and we'll get to that in a moment, but also so outrageously handsome he makes many heterosexual men question the very validity of that orientation. It's Robert Sheehan.
Well, hello there.
Hello there. Come a bit closer now to El Microfono.
Okay.
We'll get up close and personal.
Hello there.
Brad Pitt always said he hated being defined by his appearance.
Did he?
Yeah. And you, for a long time in Ireland, were a heartthrob. It's a terrible label.
It's, I suppose it's a mixed bag type label. Yeah. You know, it can be beneficial and slightly hindering all at the same time.
Ooh. Can you still walk around Dublin now? Or is it still problematic? Because I know in the eye of the love-hate storm, it was a bit uncomfortable for a while.
It was uncomfortable in the old eye of the love-hate storm. Yeah, I can walk around Dublin. Yeah, yeah. I think there's a certain, you know, after a while of being recognised, you sort of adapt and you learn to exude a fairly modest energy or projection out into the world. And you learn to not feel scared of it. You know, for at first, when you're recognised left, right and centre, immediately the energy that you're kind of projecting into the world is, oh, is that person going to recognise me? Is this, you know, and you sort of, you almost attract it, you know. And then after a while, you become more comfortable with it and you stop attracting it as much.
So did you go through that phase then of when you were talking to strangers thinking, do they know who I am?
No.
Not in an egotistical way, but in a, you know.
I suppose in Ireland, it's that anticipatory energy. If you're anticipating someone coming up and going, could I get a photo with you or something? You're sort of always slightly on edge. And so being back in Ireland, I've gone through that phase and now I'm back at the relaxed and comfortable phase where I can undo the top button of my jeans after a hefty lunch in public.
Very good. Louis C.K., you know Louis C.K., the comedian?
Absolutely.
He doesn't do photos with fans. He's, you know, he'll go, hey, let's not have a photo, but let's have a genuine human interaction.
He doesn't consent, so instead they just take a photo of him on the sly.
Yeah.
with their pocket phone.
But you find that weird that people, like, you know, their sole aim when they meet you and they're excited to meet you, but all they really care about is getting a photo, and opposed to maybe they're an interesting person and you could have a lovely 30-second interaction, but they're, photo! Okay, thanks, goodbye.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of strange, I was thought.
It's strange, but it's also, I think, to deny them that sort of, you know, because often you're right, the agenda is gather evidence that I met person, you know, and so they just want to photograph. But then if you deny them it can cause problems, you know what I mean? If you go around denying people photos all day, it's 10 times more stressful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like poor old Louis, he has to, you know, he strikes me as a man who walks around with a fairly high level of anxiety anyway. Yeah. just at a resting state. So I don't know. I'm sure it's not good for the blood pressure going around and going, no, I don't want to do a photo with you. I don't want to, you know, because you can trigger unnecessary animosity there.
Yeah, yeah. You when you stepped away from Love Hate, you were in London town. London is, it can be kind of an anonymous place, but
that's
London
very true.
Has that vibe, I think, of what can you do for me? Nothing. F*** you then. Like it doesn't give you anything.
No, you're right. I think. There's just such an avalanche of people in a concentrated geographical space in London that people, you know, people take less notice of you, I think, you know. And so certainly with the fame thing, unless it's a sort of a scheduled time and place where people expect you to be at a thing.
Well, Dave Fanning is just coming in because he's forgot his car key.
Dave, you forgot your car keys.
I forgot my car key. So sorry, so sorry.
Could you just hotwire it, for God's sake? So interesting. But yeah, you know, if One Direction are scheduled to show up at the Apple Store in Regent Street, I'm sure, you know, you'll have thousands of people all gathered there. But I'm sure if separately they're, you know, wandering down the street, you know, they would just be far less hubbub.
Yeah. You are now in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
Which also strikes me as, you know, having spent a small bit of time there just on holidays and whatnot, and a little bit for work, it strikes me as a place that, again, can be quite anonymous and not very forgiving of, you know, someone who doesn't know a lot of people or is a newbie.
Yeah, yeah. Los Angeles, the first time I went there, I was 20. No, the first time I went, I was 17, because I was in Vancouver working with an actor. And I went down for the weekend. But I remember thinking, this is what it must look like after the apocalypse. You know what I mean? I was kind of really shocked by this sort of dusty, flat, featureless nature of the city. And then due to work, I kind of bounced back and forth between this side of the world and over there over the last kind of 6 years. And slowly but surely, the place grew on me. And now I really love it, you know. And as you said, it's about being plugged in. It's about knowing people there who can take you to places that are lovely. And, you know, you realize that you're spoiled for choice as a human being in Los Angeles. You really are. You have everything at your feet. Yoga, hiking, lots of tight bike shorts.
Yeah.
Lots of toy dogs, angry little toy dogs.
Baz Luhrmann in his Sunscreen song says, live in New York, but leave before it makes you hard. Live in LA, but leave before it makes you soft. Do you see what he means?
Yeah, yeah. I think London made me a bit hard, you know. I think London can be tough to live in.
Yeah. Where do you want to end up?
That's a question that I often ask myself, Owen, and I still haven't come up with an answer, to be honest. I really, really don't know.
Time to figure it out. Did you go over there for a particular project, or did you go over there because you are an actor and you have big aspirations and you need to be there because it's the epicentre?
Yeah, I mean, LA is the epicentre for what I do. So it was kind of a combination of things, you know.
Are you there to stay? Are you there, you know?
Kind of indefinitely, yeah. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Can I mention your beautiful little half?
Why not? Mention away.
Her name is Sophia.
Yeah, that's
people
true.
Might have seen her recently in Kingsman, mm-hmm. as the what do you call the
kicking serious bottom.
She had the prosthetic blade legs in Kingsman. She was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
She's out there as well.
She lives there also. Yeah, she does.
Creative people. She's an actress as well, and you're an actor, and you're both striving for the same thing. Is that
we're both show offs, and we both we both help each other, you know, for when we've job interviews and stuff. So, yeah, it's great. You know, it's great. And that was again. I mean, it was at a point where we were kind of bouncing back and forth from one continent to the other. So, you know, the luxury of living in the same city is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it you in Louisiana? What were you filming there?
I was filming this great big sci-fi action movie called Geostorm.
Oh, right.
Which was written and directed by this guy called Dean Devlin. And Dean is kind of most notable for writing Independence Day. And he wrote Stargate.
Oh,
he's
yeah,
like,
okay.
He's one of the king nerds. And he produced those movies as well. He produces movies for Roland Emmerich a lot. This is surprisingly his directorial debut, but it was a sort of a gigantic manifestation of his nerd musings, because it's sort of a film set in the future about how global warming has essentially, you know, amped up and become humanity's greatest threat. And in efforts to combat this, all of the countries of the world have come together to create a net of anti-weather satellites around the globe, which is controlled by a central space station. And in the sort of beginnings of the movie, that space station and that net start to malfunction. So Jared Butler has to come to the space station to save the day.
Oh, well, Jared's in it. Very
Jerry's
good.
In it, yeah.
Yeah, magic. And when you think of big action films, like, if you're not, you know, a meathead action star, if someone like you who has, you know, a very good sensibility about the kind of work they want to do and stuff,
yeah,
you read a script like that, you're hardly going, well, this is going to get me an Oscar. You're just going, I'll do this because it'll be a laugh. Like, what's the motivation for that?
I think there's
a rake load of cash.
There's the old wage packet is always is quite healthy on a job like that. So that's not to be ignored. Also, there's a huge level of excitement, I think, with something like that. You know, there's the excitement of working with senior actors like Jerry Butler and Ed Harris.
Oh,
and,
class.
And Andy Garcia. You know, the thing about this movie, though, is about 50% of it is set on Earth.
Yeah.
And the other 50 is set in space. And my character is in the space bit. Ed Harris and Andy Garcia are on Earth. Because Andy Garcia is the presidente of the US in this movie. So we didn't. I didn't get to work with them really. I just I met them briefly in passing, which was a pleasure in itself. So it's nice to be. It's nice to put yourself in that pool as an actor. I think a lot of actors are aware of the fact that if you do a movie like that, you know, it's to be seen in that context is very beneficial. You know,
yeah.
And if that movie is a great success, it can shine positively on you and your career.
Yeah,
okay. So it can open doors and so. And also, you know, we got there and Dean, me and a few other actors, we sort of arrived at the same time. And Dean excitedly gave us a tour of the set, which was in NASA outside of New Orleans. We shot in a NASA assembly facility. You know, and it's just extraordinary. You know, the sheer scope and scale of a movie like that is incredibly exciting. So, yeah, all those things factor in, definitely. And plus, I'm definitely going to get an Oscar for this one.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely. I was told when I signed up. No, and also Dean, lovely Dean, wrote the part for me because he'd seen some stuff that I did and loved it. And
custom
so,
made.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
That is lovely.
So that was nice. I could hardly turn my nose up at that.
And when's that coming out? That'll be a big international release, I assume. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not coming out for ages. It's coming out like I think later on in 2016 or something.
Okay, okay. So
they have to like 3Dify it and do loads of visual effects and all that business. And also, if a studio film, I think they like to do releases. You know, obviously with a bit of breathing space between each. So then it becomes about what slot is the most suitable in the next kind of year and a half, and it seems to be at the other end of the year and a half.
Okay. The film that you're in back in Dublin town for is
back in Dublin town.
The Road Within.
That is the one, indeed. Yeah.
Tell us.
It's The Road Within is a movie that we shot in California a couple of years ago now, and it's about a guy who has really debilitating Tourette syndrome.
Yeah.
And in the beginnings of the film,
which is you.
Yeah, that's moi. That is me. And. And so at the beginning of the film, his mother has died, and we kind of learn that she was his primary caregiver, and between the two of them, they sort of locked themselves away from the world, and she drank herself to death, you know. And so all of a sudden, he's kind of thrust into the hands of his reluctant father, who's remarried, and the dad kind of throws money at the situation, puts Vincent, the character, in an experimental treatment clinic to sort of kind of fix him, you know, and in a sense, forget about him.
Yeah.
You know, the dad is a politician and doesn't want Vincent's unpredictability of his ailment to sort of sully his political campaign, you know. And so he's in this clinic and he meets these other two characters. One has really uncontrollable OCD and germophobia, and a girl who has bulimia. And the three of them then end up stealing the car of the head doctor of the clinic and just sort of heading off across America so that Vincent can scatter the ashes of his mother in the Pacific Ocean. And so it kind of becomes like a road movie with these three people with very different mental illness, all kind of completely out of their comfort zone and kind of, in a sense, sort of improve their situations a little bit. By no means do they get better or anything, but the whole experience kind of serves to make their, you know, lives more manageable.
When you read a script like that and you say, I love this, I want to do this film, like where does the line in your head lie between I really want to do this because it sounds fabulous and holy Jesus, can I pull this off? Because
yeah,
it's, you know, many really talented actors probably go through their entire careers without ever having to do something as challenging as playing someone with Tourette's, which I assume could go terribly wrong.
It could go terribly wrong, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a healthy amount of fear. But at the same time, I have a sort of a, you know, if something's really good, I have a stupid amount of bravery with something like that. You know, I can go, yeah, I can do it. I can do it, you know, we'll worry about it and we can just get down to it and rehearse and concentrate on it and be fine, you know. So I sort of, there's probably a bit of unhealthy bravado going on when I just look at something like that and go, yeah, I can pull that off.
Of course, yeah.
So, but the good thing was there was months and months of time between me being cast,
yeah,
me kind of convincing these American producers that I'm an actor because they'd never heard of me. But thankfully, the writer director liked me. And so from that point of casting to actually filming, there was like a 5-month period in which we did loads of intensive rehearsal, also with people with Tourette syndrome. So we were in good hands, and I had a healthy amount of fear, which made me very determined not to mess it up.
And so you talk to people with Tourette's about what they feel and their experience when they kind of lose control of whatever.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, we had a guy called Jackson Kramer who we got in contact with through the TSA, Tourette's Society of America. And he told us a lot of painful stuff about his adolescence and his childhood. I mean, we watched his bar mitzvah on DVD, you know, and he was like 13 when he did it. And of course, he's on stage in front of a whole audience of people, family members and friends and stuff. And when we started to watch it, I was kind of giggling because I could see him flipping off the crowd, you know, giving them the finger and trying then to conceal the fact that his hands are doing this spasm. And I was kind of going, oh God, look at you there, you know. And I was kind of fascinated by it. And I looked over and there's like tears in his eyes because he's reliving the stress and the trauma of that event, you know. And you just think, God, it's just a horrendous thing to live with, especially at that age of your life, you know. You're trying to figure out what you are, you know, and you're trying to just be normal and have friends and stuff. And so that was a moment where we kind of realized the pain of growing up with something like Tourette's, you know. I mean, I watched endless stuff. Like, there was a guy in England who has a family, and he developed Tourette syndrome in like in his late 30s, early 40s, this guy, which is highly abnormal. You know, he's small children. And you see this guy at the supermarket and he has a T-shirt on. And it says, yep, that's right, I have Tourette's, you know, in big block capitals, because he's just, you know, just flinging insults at people and like flipping people off and shouting, whistling, knocking stuff off shelves. And it's, you know, sweat pouring off his face. And he's just in a really, really intensely tough place, you know.
It's that kind of thing, even when you say that, you can't help but smile, but obviously it's so tragic for the person involved. It can
seem like madness, you know, from the outside.
Yeah, okay.
So it's I think for many, many years it was a very, very misunderstood ailment, definitely. And again, that's where the huge amounts of terror came from, taking on this job, which was, you know, to misrepresent people with Tourette syndrome in a film would be unforgivable.
Yeah.
But you know what? We got a lovely, lovely statement from Tim Howard, who's the goalkeeper for the US.
Yeah.
Soccer team, who has Tourette syndrome. He's got pretty intense Tourette syndrome.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he gave a lovely statement about the movie, saying that it encourages even people who have this debilitating ailment to go out and live a full life and don't let it stop you and stuff. And that was a direct response to the movie. So that was like huge validation.
Yeah,
to the honesty of the performance, you know. So I was delighted with that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And what's it, when will people this side of the pond get to see it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not too sure. It's going to premiere in the UK in June at Edinburgh Film Festival. And then I suppose because it's an independent movie, it's about acquiring distribution on this side of the world. So there'll be kind of our salesman will be hard at work sort of finding distribution for the movie. But I think, you know, actually at the moment, it's I think this might only be in the US, but it's on demand on iTunes at the moment, video on demand.
Oh, wow, right.
Because sometimes they do like a pre-theatrical video on demand type thing for a month. But that might just be in the US. I'm kind of the wrong guy to ask, it seems.
Do you have a plan? Do you have like a career plan, or do you just, is it kind of movie to movie?
I don't really have a plan, no. I think it's a little bit insane to try and have a 5-year plan, in the sense that, I mean, my plan ultimately is only do stuff that I'm excited by, and don't ever do anything arbitrarily, you know, because you can end up really unhappy that way. Doing something for the sake of doing it.
Like what? Like a
like a film or, you know, doing something because it's there, you know, and you might have a, you might have the next month and a half or 2 months off and someone says to you, do you want to do this? You know, it's not going to clash with anything. And you go, yeah, but that's really not the way to go. And also I think, you know, the plan is, or certainly the kind of realization is realizing your value, you know, and kind of, you know, really, really sort of only shooting for the stuff that you want to do, and everything else you would only do maybe if you're starving to death. You know what I mean?
What about something like, I'm not saying 50 Shades, but, you know, a massive franchise like that, that I think everybody knew that 50 Shades or Twilight or any of those, you know, like, I think Robert Pattinson, I don't know if you know him, like, but
I don't know.
Like, he chatted to a radio station in the UK a while ago, and he certainly didn't say he regretted doing it, but there was that kind of tone in his voice where he, you know, he really wanted to distance himself from that whole experience. And there's been all that kind of, you know, stuff about Jamie Dornan now having a hideous time since taking it on, and it's kind of, it's career defining, but not necessarily in a great way. Would you be up for that kind of big blockbuster pop culture role if it came along?
I suppose it all depends on the thing, but ultimately, you know, I'm sure Robert Pattinson and Jamie Dornan are well aware of the fact that them starring in those types of movies have facilitated 500 more doors opening, you know, and you know, 50 more scripts on the table, where they then have you know, much more power in what they can do in the future. I mean, you know, something like I mean, I did a movie called The Mortal Instruments, which was a sort of a derivation of Twilight, you know, in that sort of same genre. And I was under no illusions as to why I was doing that. I was doing that because if a movie like that proves successful, then it can, you know, essentially all actors want to get to a place where producers feel comfortable and okay with hiring them. You know what I mean? And so if they're in a movie in the US like Twilight, which made loads and loads of money, it can essentially put you in that positive sphere, in that place where you're on a list and you're considered for movies. Whereas, you know, and that's just how it works. You know, that's the sort of, I suppose. And, you know, I'm sure, like, it, you know, for Pattinson or whoever, Twilight isn't necessarily for him, in the sense that he's a man and he's like, you know, in his late 20s, early 30s. That's not really the target audience. So he may not have fully enjoyed the movie, but it's for girls from the age of, you know, 12 to whatever.
Yeah.
And beyond. And so I think you have to be very honest with your reasons for doing something like that, you know, because it can essentially facilitate more choice in the future.
Fair enough. I asked you about a bit of music, and you have chosen.
Oh yeah,
two tracks. So we'll
two very slightly obscure tracks, which I'm quite happy about.
What's certainly obscure?
I'm very bohemian.
What's the first one we're gonna play?
The first one is a singer called Sybil Byer.
Yes.
Who, do you know, I love iTunes radio because it essentially flings at you lots of random stuff. Like you might put in Nico and the Velvet Underground, and then it will give you, you know, 25 other acts that are relatively similar.
You might like this.
Exactly, yeah. And I discovered this track on that, and Sybil Byer, William is the name of the track.
Let's have a listen. One thing as well, you know, we should definitely talk about for a very brief second is, because regular listeners to the show will know that we have a weekly feature where we discuss topic du jour with the great Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It's great to see Arnold Schwarzenegger keeping so up to date about topical events in Ireland, isn't it?
Water charges, movie releases, whatever it is. And Arnie has the junior cert.
Now, the junior cert.
well, they're trying to change the syllabus here. It's been big news. And Arnold had some sage advice, of course. But I know most people will be absolutely flabbergasted to hear this, but that's not actually the real Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's a very talented Englishman, and he wouldn't be here. I know people enjoy listening to him on the show. He wouldn't be here were it not for Robert Sheen's introducing of me to this man, Joe Sangre.
I'm very much the Cupid between RTE and screaming Joe Sangre. I shot you guys with a love arrow. And just let you express together.
Maybe anytime Joe is on the show being Arnold, there should be a little brought to you by Robert Sheehan jingle.
Yeah, I mean, it might be overshadowing. It might be stealing his thunder a little bit.
Well, you know.
Yeah. He told me recently that he's going to write his autobiography and it's going to be called Pumping Irony. He's a comic genius, Joe Sangre. He really is.
He's a very talented man. So thank you for that introduction, and I'm sure the listeners thank you also. Rob, thanks for coming in. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed the chat. You're off now. How long are you in Dublin for?
Only until tomorrow. And then I'm off to London Tan for about 5 or 6 days and then back to the old Americas.
Did you get any quality family time in, or did it become a bit of a work hoopla?
It was very work hoopla. It was kind of multitasking. It was kind of gathering family members at work hoopla events. But yeah, you know, I saw everyone, hugged them, sort of reminded them that I'm alive. So
it's good to know.
So yeah, it's been sort of a, I mean, it's one of those things where if you're coming home for a fairly short window, then you start stacking things that you have to do all into that window and kind of packing everything in, including family, bless them. So they're very sweet and considerate to me.
So we don't know when the road will be released, so we're not sure exactly when we'll see you on the big screen next.
Yes, let me think. There's another movie called Moonwalkers.
What the hell?
Which is coming out later in the year, but that's in the US again. I have no useful information about my career. But no, that was just on at South by Southwest in Austin. And then it sort of got distribution off the back of it premiering there.
Oh, fab.
And that's with Rupert Grint and Ron Perlman. And it's a sort of a madcap comedy set in the 60s.
Rupert Grint, he of Harry Potter fame.
Of Harry Potter fame, indeed, yes. The ginger Adonis. Yeah, it is. And second movie with Ron as well.
Oh, very good. You've really got a nice little repertoire.
Little family there, you know, a little clan. Yeah, it's nice to it's nice to reunionise and work with folk like that again.
Yeah. Good peoples. We appreciate you coming in, and we're going to play out on your final musical choice.
Oh, yeah.
Of the evening, which is?
This is a funky dance track called On the Regular by Shamir.
Oh, yeah. Let's get down. Robert Sheehan, thanks a mil.
It's been a pleasure, my love.
Howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Well, everyone is minus, you could call me multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You could give my fingers and I'm not waving high. Yes, I'm never ending, you could call me pie. But really, how long till the world realize? Yes, yes, I'm the best. What you heard, anything less is
obviously absurd.
Haters get the bird, more like an eagle. This is my movie, stay tuned for the sequel. Seems so wrong, seems so illegal. Got this in the back like a foul ball free throw. Yep, you know that I go.
2FM with Owen McDermott.